We're going to start out today's show with our Africa Watch occasional series that we are bringing to you. And I'd like to welcome our guest, Dr. Gerald Horn, who's the Morris Professor of History and African American Studies at the University of Houston. He's written more than 30 books, including his most recently published books, Facing the Rising Sun, African Americans, Japan, and the Rise of Afro-Asian Solidarity, The Apocalypse of Settler Colonialism, The Roots of Slavery, White Supremacy, and Capitalism in 17th Century North America and the Caribbean, and Storming the Heavens, African Americans in the Early Fight for the Right to Fly. Dr. Horn, welcome.
Thank you for inviting me.
Okay, Dr. Horn, we will have your comments in just a moment, but just giving our listeners a bit of background here. We are going to start off, Dr. Horn, with our Africa Watch. Actually, we'll first discuss the Sudan, and then we will move on to Libya and Algeria, if that is okay with you.
Oh, sure.
And right. So the 30-year leader of the Sudan was deposed by the military. Protesters have stayed on the streets. They're refusing to step down until a civilian government has been established. Part of the background is after years of fighting, the Sudan was balkanized. It was divided in two with the formation of South Sudan and a row between the North, ruled by Bashir, and the newly formed South Sudan broke out over oil-rich fields, which got taken over by the newly formed South. Bashir's Sudan not only faced U.S. sanctions, but also, along with the loss of oil revenue, led to the economic crisis that many are protesting now on the streets. So who are the protesters who have vowed to stay in the streets until a civilian government is formed? What's at stake in the Sudan? What we're going to do is we're going to go to a clip from Al Jazeera about what the protesters are demanding.
Despite a military coup ousting Bashir last Thursday and his successor 24 hours later, the sit-in and protests continue.
We insist on continuing with this revolution until our demands are met. Our demands are known and clear, bringing down the regime completely.
They're angry because they feel their revolution is being stolen by the military council that overthrew Bashir. The council has appointed members from the military to run the country. It's promised an all-party inclusive government for the transitional period, but under the military's supervision. That's something those on the streets refuse to accept.
Protesters have been here in front of the army headquarters in Khartoum for more than 10 days, and they say they're ready to stay for even longer if their demands are not met. They want the dismantling of the security and intelligence agency, as well as accountability for the members of the former regime. But most of all, they want a civilian government in a country that has been ruled by a military leader for more than 30 years.
The military council says it won't use force to disperse the protesters, something activists say they attempted to do on Monday morning. It has issued orders to reform the security agency and the judiciary and says it's arrested officials from the previous government who will be held to account. But it insists protest groups and political parties must agree on the structure of a transitional government.
We need to agree on the basis of forming the government. The ball is now in their court. There was a question on the timeline, but the ball is in the court of political forces and other bodies that I mentioned, from organizations, youth, and women. If they're ready today and agree on anything, we are ready to execute.
Yeah, so Dr. Gerald Horn, you know, a lot of people are watching this and not recalling the earlier history of the Sudan, including the conflict in Darfur, the dividing up of the country with the formation of South Sudan, a government that was very much backed in the South by the United States, and sanctions being slapped on Bashir's government. Now, that doesn't excuse Bashir, and likely there's very good reason that the protesters are out on the street. But just remind us a bit about that history, Dr. Horn.
Well, you mentioned the conflict in Darfur, which is a factor in terms of Mr. al-Bashir being charged before the International Criminal Court. One of the issues at play right now is whether or not his military comrades will dispatch him to The Hague. I tend to think not least because the International Criminal Court has lost credibility because, as you know, they had supposedly embarked on investigating U.S. human rights violations in Afghanistan, but seemingly have dropped that initiative, not least because the U.S. authorities refused to give the chief prosecutor of the ICC a visa to enter the United States of America. In any case, you are correct to focus on this history. South Sudan had a good deal of oil wealth and still does, except now it's not under the regime of the Khartoum-based government. Recall that a leader of South Sudan still wears a Texas cowboy hat, an homage to George W. Bush, who was so instrumental in helping to push South Sudan towards independence. In some ways, what's happening in Sudan is one of the last chapters of the Cold War. Recall that when Mr. al-Bashir first came to power in the 1980s, he was in bed with religious zealots who considered themselves to be Muslims, but that was considered to be acceptable to the United States. Recall that Osama bin Laden himself had sought sanctuary in Sudan, and one of the reasons why Washington looked the other way at this kind of alliance was because Sudan had one of the strongest left-wing movements on the African continent, the Sudanese Communist Party, which is now prominent in the demonstrations in Khartoum, was the most significant Communist Party on the African continent outside of South Africa. But now, with the collapse of the Soviet Union, and Washington in some ways is willing to sacrifice Mr. al-Bashir, although winking at him for decades. Recall also that the demonstrators are keeping on the streets or remaining on the streets because they fear that what happened in Egypt will befall what happens in Sudan, the southern neighbor of Egypt. Recall that Hosni Mubarak, in the early stages of what was called the Arab Spring, the longtime, long-term dictator in Cairo, was forced out of power. That led to Mohamed Morsi, a Muslim Brotherhood leader, surging to power in Cairo, replaced by General al-Sisi, the current leader of Egypt, who was just in the Oval Office by the White House, even though he's hatching plans as we speak to stay in office to 2030 or perhaps even 2024. There is a fear amongst protesters if they're not careful, that kind of saga will unfold in Sudan.
Yeah, and Dr. Horn, it's just interesting that the protesters are getting quite a bit of play in mainstream media in Europe as well as here in the United States. And that might have to do with the, Sudan being important, the oil wealth there, but also the ongoing struggle between North and South. But it's interesting also to see that so many women are out on the street, a huge percentage of the protesters, and they're protesting oppression against women, having to live under Sharia law, etc. But it's just interesting to me that the coverage that's getting, where they're demanding that their president step down, as opposed to an island nation like Haiti, where protesters have been on the street demanding that their president step down. But in the case of Haiti, their president is being backed by the United States, not so in the Sudan. Dr. Horn, any comments on that?
Well, I would make a couple of points. One is that a number of professional organizations are prominent in terms of the protests in Sudan, particularly doctors and lawyers, and both groups have a complement of women in the leadership. You might have seen the iconic photograph that's emerged from the protests in Sudan with a woman with her finger gesticulating, making very pointed remarks, which has gone viral across the internet. Secondly, Mr. al-Bashir was able to remain in power, not least because he had various contending security factions, and he was at the center of this spider web. This began to fall apart, however, just about 10 days ago when various security factions were actually at each other's throats about to fire on one another and unleashing perhaps a violent civil war. And it's at that point that top military leaders stepped in and told Mr. al-Bashir that he had to go. That is to say, he had to relinquish his hold on the top civilian leadership. It's unclear as we speak what is going to happen in Sudan, whether or not an Egyptian-type scenario will unfold, or whether or not the protesters in the streets will stay firm and help to foil the military's plan to stay in power for 2 years to manage what they call a, quote, transition, unquote.
Right, and the woman you referred to is known as Kandaka, or Nubian Queen, that was seen leading a chants, and also the Sudanese Professionals Association, or SPA, is described as a collaboration of doctors, health workers, and lawyers who are said to be leading the demonstrations. But, you know, unless you're really there on the ground, you really don't know. They might have initiated the demonstrations, but it seems as though they're very widespread, with tens of thousands participating. So we'll see how all of this plays out, Dr. Horn. What we're going to do now is to move on to the conflict happening in Libya. And of course, on March 19th, 2011, the U.S.-backed NATO coalition began a military invasion in Libya, where they deposed Muammar Gaddafi's government in the most brutal way. And the country has been a mess, frankly, since then. And we'll talk a little bit, too, about what that overthrow of Muammar Gaddafi in Libya has meant, not only for Libya itself, but for the region. But let us go to a short clip from Al Jazeera on the situation in Libya.
As Libya's conflict escalates, a dangerous double game is emerging. Western and regional powers are backing rival sides, even as they publicly call for calm. Will they ever cooperate and help stop the violence? It's been 8 years since the fall of Libya's leader Muammar Gaddafi, and the nation is once again at risk of an all-out war. Rival forces are intensifying their fight to control Tripoli. Troops loyal to the UN-backed government in the capital are trying to stop the advance of the warlord Khalifa Haftar. Libya has had two rival governments over the last few years. The UN-recognized administration led by Prime Minister Fayez al-Sarraj is based in the capital, Tripoli. Most Western nations support the unity government, including Italy, which is worried that the fighting will force more migrants to cross the Mediterranean. Qatar and Turkey also back Sarraj. In the east, there is the Tobruk-based government, the center of power for Khalifa Haftar. He is backed by Egypt, Saudi Arabia, and the United Arab Emirates. France is also accused of providing military support to Haftar, and Russia recently vetoed a UN Security Council statement to condemn his advance on Tripoli. Now, protesters in Tripoli have urged the foreign ministry to summon the ambassadors of Egypt, the UAE, Saudi Arabia, and France, and they say they want Libya's representatives to the UN, Arab League, and the African Union to take measures against Haftar.
So there you go, Dr. Horn. So your take on what is happening here. I mean, since the fall of Muammar Gaddafi, the U.S. press, mainstream press, they've been so focused on what happened in Benghazi in 2012 and the so-named Clinton connection, which was used against her in her bid to become president of the United States. And of course, that was a incident in Benghazi where the U.S. Ambassador Chris Stephen was killed, along with other foreign U.S. Foreign Service representatives. But there's been a lot more going on in Libya. Tell us about how you see what's happening in Libya now, and also the role that the fall of the U.S.-backed fall of Muammar Gaddafi has meant for the entire region. Dr. Horn.
Well, the fall of Gaddafi obviously was catastrophic for the people of Libya in the first place, but also it's reverberated, I'm afraid to say, not only southward into sub-Saharan Africa, but northward across the Mediterranean into Italy itself. What I mean is that with the collapse of government and civil authority in Tripoli, Libya has become a gateway for African refugees seeking to cross the choppy waters of the Mediterranean to find refuge and sanctuary in Italy in particular. But the problem there has been that, number one, many of them have drowned in the Mediterranean, And number two, their presence in Italy itself has initiated a kind of counter-reaction by dint of manipulation by demagogic politicians who point to their presence in order to generate racism, which has led to a kind of unique neo-fascism erupting in Rome, in the center of government in Italy. It's also interesting to note that General Haftar, who was the main focus of the brief interlude that you played just a moment or so ago, is backed by a broad array of forces. Just before launching his attack on Tripoli, he had met with the leadership in Saudi Arabia. He's backed by Egypt, as your interlude suggested. He is also receiving support from the United Arab Emirates. He's receiving a kind of support from Russia and from France as well. He also is a partial U.S. citizen. Recall that he had come to power with Muammar al-Qaddafi in 1969, but broke with him and spent a good deal of his exile living in Virginia. The central government in Tripoli is not very popular, not least because it's seen as being beholden to religious zealots and to gangsters who maraud and loot the population. Sadly enough, I'm afraid to say that a kind of slavery has erupted in Libya as well, with darker-skinned people, particularly these African refugees that I was just making reference to, being sold on the open market. Is rather ironic, if not paradoxical, that the first black president, Barack Obama, helped to engineer an overthrow of Gaddafi that led to the rise of slavery in Libya. Ironic, of course, because Mr. Obama was backed by many descendants of enslaved Africans himself. In any case, oil is never far from the picture when one talks about Libya, as the United States tries to force Venezuelan and Iranian oil off the market. This makes Libyan oil all the more important. I should also say it makes Russian oil all the more important as well, and Russia might be a prime beneficiary of this entire episode, this tragedy we see unfolding in North Africa.
Yeah, and indeed, the oil reserves in Libya, as you say, are really vital. They are the largest on the continent of Africa, it is being reported, and among the 10 largest globally, with about 46.4 billion barrels as of 2010. And just this morning, I was reading an article that the price of oil per barrel has gone up over worries about the destabilization of the uprising going on in Libya, as well as the curtailing by U.S. sanctions of oil coming from Venezuela. So we'll have to see how all of that plays out. And indeed, you're right to point out that that NATO-U.S. invasion, that overthrow, Muammar Gaddafi, installed a religious fundamentalist government that was aligned with Saudi Arabia, it is reported. And it's also reported that it oversaw the mass enslavement of black Libyans and sympathizers of Muammar Gaddafi. And just yesterday, the UN-backed government in Tripoli told Sky News that there could be an influx of more than 800,000 migrants from Libya to Europe if the instability continues. So a way of putting some pressure on there. We could spend more time on this, but let us move on then to another hotspot that's happening. And in relation to protesters who have been out on the streets and demanding yet another president step down, and that's in Algeria. So tell us about the situation here in Algeria, Dr. Horn.
Well, as you know, long-term President Bouteflika has just been forced out of office. He had been in power for about 20 years. He's in his early 80s. Yet he has not spoken in public for about 6 years. He is in a wheelchair and is seemingly barely holding on to life. What happened is that the military and those described colloquially as, quote, the power, unquote, forced him to step down and forced in a replacement. It's unclear whether or not that will satisfy the protesters. Keep in mind that Algeria was subject to a bitter war of national liberation before coming to power in before the Liberation Front came to power in 1962. France was the colonizing power, but France saw Algeria the way the United States sees Hawaii, that is to say, as part of France itself. And in fact, there was a very substantial French-born population in Algeria who leaned to the right. They basically tried to ignite a settlers' revolt, not unlike the settlers' revolt, by the way, that led to the formation of the United States of America in 1776. But it was crushed, ultimately, and it was very bloody. In fact, you can see this in part in the film The Battle of Algiers, which the Black Panther Party used to use for political education. Speaking of the Black Panther Party, it's important to point out that during the 1960s and 1970s, Algeria was one of the closest allies of the Black Panther Party. Recall that there was a legation there, led for a while by Kathleen Cleaver and Eldridge Cleaver. Field Marshal Donald Cox, who was also in Algeria, has just published a memoir published by Heyday Books in Berkeley that details his stay in Algeria. And so I think it's important to say that just like Libya was very important to the Black Liberation Movement in the United States of America, not least because Gaddafi reaching out in terms of solidarity and also in terms of funding to certain Black nationalist groups, Algeria has also been important in that very same way. Also like Libya, Algeria is a major hydrocarbon power, not only a producer of oil, but of natural gas as well. And that suggests that Washington is keeping a very close and careful eye on the tumultuous events that are unfolding as we speak in Algeria.
Yeah. Excuse me. It seems, Dr. Horn, that the youth across in Sudan as well as Algeria are definitely flexing their muscles and making their voices heard, sending a message to the previous generation. And also, one has to wonder how much has been learned by the protesters in those countries with what happened in Egypt. We were all so excited about the Arab Spring in Egypt, and look at how that has ended up. So, Dr. Horn, thank you so very much for joining us and breaking this down for us. We want to do a lot more on the continent of Africa, where most, in a way, of the world's wealth beneath the ground lay. And I should also mention that Libya, in addition to being very, very rich in oil, they have some really large reserves of water, which a lot of people don't know about. And of course, we know that the battle for water is going to be key in the international fight over resources. So, Dr. Gerald Horn, thank you for joining us. We hope to hear from you on our weekly roundtable on Friday and hope to be seeing you in Southern California in July. Thank you for joining us, Dr. Horn.
Thank you for inviting me.